Hola Barcelona, welcome to the new English Radio Barcelona Blue on La Marina Cat 102.5 FM. I'm Virgil, still and always. Well, here in Barcelona, we're blessed with some of the best healthcare in the world. And joining us today to talk about it is a friend, former guest, medical oncologist, attending physician at Valdebron University Hospital, Dr. Joaquin Mateo. Welcome to the show again.
Hello, Virgil. It's a pleasure to be back here, as always.
Yeah, we've had some fun over the years. But again, now, by definition, you're a cancer physician treating those impacted by the disease. But cancer is not something new. Now, we've even found prostate cancer in the tissues of some of the mummies from ancient Egypt. So why haven't we been able to find a cure for it?
Well, that's a tough one to start.
Well, hey.
I think that part of the challenge comes from the fact that cancer cells are still more similar than different to the rest of the cells in our body. So let's put in comparison with infectious diseases, who have been the major healthcare problem of our society until probably some 100 years ago, right? In the end, we have been able to find a way to kill virus or microbia using substances that do not affect our normal human cells, because virus or bacteria are very different to human cells.
True.
So once you know how different they are, you can attack them using something that does not affect your cells. On the other hand, cancer cells arise from our normal cells. So even if they undergo a number of changes that make them abnormal, they are still our own cells. So they are still mostly similar to our cells. So most of the things that can kill cancer cells would also kill normal cells. So it's a matter of finding that fine equilibrium about targeting something in the cancer cell that is not that important for the normal cell, so it's not affected. And I think we have made tremendous progress, particularly in the last 20 to 30 years, but the development of better treatments also comes by better understanding how cancer cells change and become cancerous and how they become different. In what aspects are they different to normal cells? Because these are the aspects that we can attack.
Well, I think the whole thing is it's part of the medical thinking that's kind of evolved recently is that we're not so much looking for the cure per se as how we can best manage the cancer so that people can live with it. Now, so how do you counsel patients relative to this distinction, and how would you suggest our listeners talk with their own physicians about this if they had a similar choice?
I think that our objective is to cure cancer in the field of research, no doubt about it. It is true that, unfortunately, sometimes we encounter patients where by the time that we diagnose the disease, we know it is unlikely we are going to be able to cure it. Okay, either because it has spread to other organs or because of our experience with prior patients, we know that it's very unlikely that it will disappear. So the concept of cure is a bit blurry for those situations, right? But as a physician, our objective is to make our patients live longer and better, whether it is with the disease or by eliminating the disease. That may not be necessarily the main issue, but actually the fact that they can have good quality of life and ideally for as long as possible. And we try to be very, very transparent with patients. If we find a disease that we think we are not going to be able to cure, that doesn't mean we are not going to take care of those patients and do our best. So the disease causes as few problems as possible for as many years as possible.
And I think that's the whole thing. I think the ability now we're seeing more and more people living with the disease that, you know, just a few years ago would not have lived. You know, they would not have had any options at all. So I think the fact that there's, you know, researchers like yourself that have made so much progress in terms of being able to develop drugs and protocols that control the disease to the point where people can live with it is something that's really incredible.
Well, it is, it's probably the most rewarding part of this job when you actually develop or help develop a new treatment and then you see it making a difference for patients. And as you say, now we have plenty of therapeutic options that we can use. And we know that many of them in the setting of, as we were discussing, patients where maybe the disease has spread already to other organs. We know that each of the treatments on their own may not be curative and may work for a period of time, but we are also learning on how to use them sequentially, so we can then prolong the benefit. And one of the things that I'm more interested on is whether we can actually anticipate the changes in the tumor and, you know, get ahead of the tumor in this evolutionary process, so we can prevent that the disease gets in, the patient with symptoms again.
We'll be back to talk more with our guest right after this. And that was Chad Tuthill with Still Barkin'. Now, we were just talking a little bit earlier about the fact that there have been a lot of drugs that have come on the scene that have helped people at an advanced stage disease. Now, many of these drugs currently being used to treat prostate cancer, as an example, have side effects that affect the cardiovascular system, the skeletal structure, cognitive functions, and other parts of the body and mind, with no chance for cure. Now, what are your conversations in life with patients who say that they don't want these negative impacts in their life? They'd rather just, you know, deal with the disease on its own without having to be impacted by these other things that can seriously affect them.
Well, it is true that most treatments come at the price of some side effects. I mean, some are very well tolerated, but it's true that some others may come with all these problems that you mentioned. And I think that the point you made is quite fair. I mean, there are patients who feel like it's not worth it for them. And that just comes down to a fair and honest conversation between the physician and the patient. I think that as a doctor, I try to build trust with my patients so we can have this conversation, understand what are the priorities that can be different from one patient and to the other, and then just try to explain to patients in a way that they can understand, because they may not be scientists or physicians, what are the chances of these side effects and how much are they going to impact their quality of life. And then you have to respect the opinion of patients, and once you understand their priorities and what they value the most, then try to design the best care plan for them. What I don't like is sometimes some colleagues who may say, like, okay, if he doesn't want this treatment, he doesn't want treatment, then I'm, you know, I don't have to do anything about this patient anymore. No, you just have to adjust your care to the preferences of the patient.
I think this whole thing is that, you know, we've often talked, you know, about the needs of the patient. And from my standpoint, there were really two key things. A patient always wants to know, you know, what is it you're going to do? What's going to happen to me? What are my future possibilities? But at the same time, they want to be known. They want you to know what they're concerned about, what their needs are, what their priorities are for life. So again, so you got to start thinking about, all right, if this drug that I give them is going to impact on that particular thing they want to do, how do I adjust it? How do I talk to them? How do I have the conversation?
Well, first of all, the concept that patients want to know, as you said, I may challenge that sometimes.
Really? As
sometimes, particularly in the field of cancer, that we know it's a disease that has a big impact in our society, and it's still kind of a taboo sometimes. There are some patients, and that may change in different cultures, but here in the Mediterranean culture, it is true that there is a proportion of patients who are reluctant to have an open conversation about the disease, and that may come from fears or, you know, preconceptions about what's going to happen. And I think that it's important that as we build this patient-doctor trust relationship that I mentioned about before, you also adjust the pace at which you give all this information to every patient, so it's not, you know, too much of a cumbersome information for the patient. Then patients want to be known, yes, and I think that we are there to help them. So it is important that we understand what they value the most. And this is something that in the field of research has probably been underappreciated for some times. And when we do clinical trials is when we try new drugs and we give them to patients, real patients with real cancers, and we see how they do, whether they do go better or not with a new treatment. In the last 10 to 15 years, there is an emerging field of capturing the experience of patients reported by themselves, not by laboratory tests or by imaging scans, but capturing what the patient feels. At the moment, it's done through questionnaires, like written questionnaires that the patient fills in paper or online.
Patient-reported outcomes.
Correct. Patient-reported outcomes, we call it. I think it's still not the perfect way to do it, because it's still the patient answering the questions that the physician has agreed to do. But it's the best way that we have so far, but we have to evolve to other means for the patient to be proactive in giving us their perspective. on the effects of new drugs.
Now, with the patient-reported outcomes, and I'm involved with it quite a bit, and some of the research that, you know, get involved in funding, is how much of that data that the patients report really go into changing the research protocol or the care protocol? You know, it's a case where, you know, you look at the questionnaire and it says, you know, do you feel better this week on a scale of 1 to 10? Is your pain better, whatever? How does that really go into changing?
So when we run clinical trials, the final objective is that if the new drug works, we would go to a regulatory agency like the FDA in the US or the European Medicament Agency and ask them to approve the drug. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that while these agencies are very much supportive of collecting these patient-recorded outcomes, they are still not used to make the final decision on whether the drug is approved or not. And that also kind of create a scenario where there is no support to really invest on that kind of research because it's not being used for the final aim of a clinical trial. Having said so, it is very important to collect this data, and it's very helpful to collect this data, for example, in post-approval studies where patients are getting treatments and we can capture in a wider population. Because, you know, in clinical trials, clinical trials are run at a few hospitals, big hospitals, and not the majority of patients are being treated at hospitals. So post-approval studies are also very helpful to understand how drugs impact quality of life of patients. And in that respect, patient-reported outcomes are very, very important in these post-approval studies. And we are running several of them here at Vall d'Hebron and other centers in Spain, just trying to capture the experience of the patient through the number of years as the patient goes through different treatments. And for example, there is one that is called the Ironman Registry, where it's not only the patients who will fill these questionnaires every 3 months, but actually I would be getting questionnaires that would ask me, how do I think that the patient is feeling? And part of the research in that protocol is to understand if doctors are really getting it, like if they are really prioritizing the things that the patient is actually valuing the most. And I think this is a very interesting exercise. It's still ongoing. Probably we'll need a couple more years to get at results least on it, but I think it's going to be a very interesting exercise.
Well, as always, you start to change the existing standard of care. It's never easy, which kind of again brings back another issue. Another important thing that, you know, relates to advanced stage care is something that we've seen in the U.S. particularly, but potentially here as well, is the concept of financial toxicity, which can be defined as the harm to patients that results from treatment costs. So do you see a time coming here in Spain where the healthcare system simply can't afford the costs of many of these new drugs, and they will force patients to pay a greater share of that cost or not to give them the drugs?
Yes, financial toxicities are clearly the impact. So they refer to the impact of cancer, not only the drugs, but the disease, in the quality of life of the patient from the perspective of their ability to continue their normal life in terms of their jobs, their financial wellness. There are two main kinds of financial toxicities. One is derived from the cost of the treatment. That's clearly an issue in the US and other countries. Here in Europe, and particularly in Spain, because we have universal healthcare systems, it's not exactly the same, but it's still an issue. So it's not like one patient may not be able to cover the cost, but as a system, we may not be able to cover the cost of some treatments. So all patients with a given disease may not have access to a drug that may be approved in other parts of the world. So different phases of the same problem. Clearly, when it comes to individual patient inequalities to access a drug, there is an additional component of different groups in our societies maybe more pro to have worse outcomes for cancer because of this. So that's part one, the financial toxicity, and clearly it's a problem also in Europe as new drugs are very expensive and we have to define clear rules on what are we all going to pay for, okay? There is another part of financial toxicity that is the impact of the disease in the patient being able to continue their professional careers, in the cost if they have to adapt their houses to new physical inabilities, and all those, of course, impact patients all over the world. And here, again, there is always the worry that those that have less may be more prone to suffer because they may have less resources to adapt, right? And maybe to quit their jobs if they have to. And that's an issue that many patients suffer. It is sometimes difficult for us as clinicians to help them because the healthcare system is not necessarily connected with the social system of support, but we do have now integrated into hospitals and into primary care systems the role of social workers that help orientate the patient towards finding support from different institutions, from the government, but also public charities that support patients when they are facing these issues.
Well, I think, again, it's important because it is an integrative problem. And the solutions are going to have to be integrated throughout all of society as well.
And I think that what is very important, if you know patients are listening to us or someone who's listening to us unfortunately may become a patient eventually, is that don't be afraid to ask and to mention that to your doctors, because I mean they may know how they may connect you to someone who can help you, but sometimes it's something that we oversee in our conversation. So please mention it if that's something that is making you feel anxious as a patient. Mention it to your doctor, to the nurses, or to anyone in the hospital, and they may point you to the right person.
We'll be back to talk more with Joaquin right after this. And that was Randy Sharp with Arriba. Well, we saw the impact of the COVID pandemic that it had on healthcare overall in Spain. Given that we fully haven't characterized the virus and that it's still mutating, do you anticipate we will see another wave of it or another flu-like virus coming that could, you know, hit us again like COVID did?
Well, I mean, there are waves of COVID nowadays. We know, but fortunately, because most of the population got the vaccine, they are not impacting people as the first wave. So that's for sure. The virus is still around and will be, as many other viruses have been incorporated into our ecosystem. So when when you go to medical school, there is a major called history of medicine, and there is another on epidemiology. And in both, one of the things that you study is dynamics of viral pandemics.
Right.
And I can remember, I mean, I perfectly remember the day I got this class. I was in this class. I remember who the teacher was, who showed us the graph showing that every 10 years there is a small peak of flu, and once every 100 years there is a major peak of a new virus. And I remember they say, and the last one was in 1918. So, you know, around, that was 2000 and 2002, right. 2003, that I was in medical school. Like, so around 2020 or so, there should be another one. And, you know, we all quite laugh about it. But what I say is that it is predictable, and it's going to, it has happened for centuries, and it probably continued to happen because all microorganisms evolve over time. And when they evolve, when the change in the evolution is small, the impact in the health of humans is not that big. And this is why, you know, we get flu every year, and despite flu kills people, that's true, most of us get over the annual flu without major problems. But once every 10 years, something changes, and 10 years is an approximate, just by chance, that it changes so much from one year to another that then your body is not used to it. And then it's that year when, you know, the emergency rooms collapse and everything is having a bad flu that winter. Also, for new virus, if you look historically, approximately once per century, there is a peak of a new pandemic. So yes, it will continue to happen. We don't have to get crazy about it. And we just have to use the tools that we have now that are much better than those that we had 200 years ago to take the measures so it doesn't impact in our society as much as the prior ones.
Well, you know, I had some friends come in this past week from California, and they're walking around in masks. And it's, you know, it's like, it looks strange because the only time we see masks now, we go to the pharmacy or we go into the hospital or to the clinic. That's the only time we see people having masks and having to wear masks. So it comes up the fact of saying, is there still a communicable risk out here that we should be concerned about?
There is, but I don't think it's much better than the risk of getting a flu. Okay? But let me go back to February 2020. I was on my way to the US. I was going to a medical conference in California, and the lady sitting next to me in the airplane was wearing a face mask. Okay, and you know, by then it was when there were already cases in China. And I think that was that same week that there were a few cases reported in Italy. But honestly, and I'm a physician, I was worried about the situation. My first reaction was like, what's wrong with her? And I think that now we know that this is a tool that we can use in certain circumstances. So I don't think we have to wear masks when we walk around, but probably it will be reasonable that in the winter, if I have a cold and I may have a flu, it may be prudent that if I'm in the public transport, I'm wearing a mask because I am reducing the probabilities of transmitting it to others. I think that just adopting some common sense measures that will be staying with us for the future may help preventing worse outcome from some of these infections, particularly in vulnerable people.
Right. Us folks over the age of 50 and 60 and all the rest of it, yes, that's very true. Now, with that in mind, you know, you talked a little bit about preventive measures down the road based about, you know, the research in terms of being able to look ahead of it. Are there things that we could be doing right now that would be considered cancer preventive lifestyle changes?
Well, I'm sure that many things that we are doing now in medicine and in cancer medicine in particular are going to be seen as really stupid things in 50 years from now. Okay, but this is just because our knowledge keeps increasing every year. And there are things that we used to do to treat cancer 50 years ago that now, you know, you look back, it's like, why were they doing that? But because we didn't have the knowledge then, we didn't understand how the disease was. So yes, definitely many of the things that we are doing now will be seen as an error in 50 years. We just have to try to learn as fast as possible. If your question goes about dietary and lifestyles conditions, I think it's difficult to adopt measures to prevent cancer directly. I think that we have to try to implement measures and lifestyles to promote health rather than to prevent one disease. Because if you prevent cancer, but you end up dying of a stroke, it's not better, right? So it's promoting wellness and good health habits in our lifestyle rather than targeting in preventing one or the other disease, because you're never going to be able to prevent them all.
It's true. Because one of the things that, you know, obviously you're working on is now looking at the various genes in our system, in our body, that have been cancer-sensitive genes that we don't know if they are actually causing the cancer, but they are present during the cancers. And there's a lot of research being done now. They're looking at people to do genetic testing to see if they have these genes in their system. Do you think that this is going to be something that we need to do? You know, should we look to start getting a genetic array done? Yeah.
So when we talk about genetic testing in cancer, there are two different aspects. One is looking at your genetic composition in your normal cells. That sometimes can help identify individuals with a higher risk of cancer than others. But that's a very, very small group of the population. It's very difficult than by targeting a random group of people in the street and doing genetic tests to all of them, you're gonna find anything that will change the way this person should continue their daily life. Right. Okay. So this kind of genetic testing is more oriented towards high risk individuals, maybe based on detecting several cases of cancer in the same family. There is another part of genetic testing that is about looking at the genes in the tumor, because one of the characteristics of the tumor cells is that they change their DNA and they adopt new changes that favor their growth. But this is only for patients, not for health individuals. So there are companies now trying to sell products for genetic testing in the healthy population. Some of them are more from the perspective of, oh, I'm going to try to find your grandfather. Yeah. Some others is, oh, I'm going to try to find your predisposition to diseases. I think they may have a role in the future, but at present, I don't think they are helpful if you apply them in a anyone coming or anyone through the door approach. And they have a better role right now if you target high-risk populations based in other criteria.
We'll be back with Dr. Mateo right after this. We'll be right back. And that was Roger Rivas with Autumn Breeze. Now, one of the emerging trends in healthcare today is AI, or artificial intelligence. What is it, and what are the benefits that you see accruing to patients?
That's a very hot topic. How are we going to use AI to improve healthcare? I mean, there are many ways to use AI to improve financially some people, but it's like, how are we going to make it for, you know, use it for good for patients? I see two main applications of AI, or two broad applications, and there are more, okay? But the two main is, one, whether we can do the things that we already do in a more efficient manner, and two is whether we can do new things. The first one, can we do the things that we already know how to do, but in a more efficient manner? Let me put you an example. Screening for breast cancer. Women go and get a mammogram, okay? And out of 100 healthy women that get a mammogram, like 0 to 1 will actually end up having cancer, okay? So there is a radiologist sitting in a dark room somewhere that will have to read 100 mammograms in an hour, maybe. I'm just making this up. Maybe it's 2 hours. I don't know. Out of the 100, 90 will be absolutely normal. 5 or 7, you know, the radiologist will have some hesitations, but will be normal. And there will be another 4 or 5 that really will be suspicious, and that person will go to have further tests. One application of AI is that if we can train a computer to identify patterns and identify the mammograms that are clearly normal, those 90 that the radiologist will have no doubt whatsoever that they are normal, maybe the machine can already discard them. And then the radiologist can spend their expert time in just looking at the 10 that are suspicious, okay? So in that respect, there are many applications of AI to diagnosis of cancers that are just trying to optimize the diagnosis by kind of identifying the extremes, the cases that are clearly normal or clearly diseased, but today we still need the expertise to, you know, define this middle ground. Maybe in 20 years from now we can clear, but this is one application. The other that is more interesting for me as a researcher is, can we use AI to create new things? And in the field of cancer, you mentioned before that I work in understanding cancer genomics, so looking at the genes in the tumors. And when we look at the genome of a tumor, we produce a huge amount of data. And still, we are limited in how do we interpret that data. We end up looking for, you know, 200 or 300 genes that we know are relevant and look for isolated events. I think that AI, the capacity of AI to recognize patterns may help us go beyond what we do now by identifying patterns in genomics data, but also in imaging data or in pathology data that can identify complex biomarkers that with our current tools we are not able to develop. But also, it can help us to create patterns integrating different modalities of data. So I look at the genes, okay? Another researcher look at the pathology. Another researcher look at the imaging. AI doesn't really care where the data comes from, okay? So you feed data from different disciplines, and AI models can try to integrate and weight them differently to correlate them with outcomes. So that's a field of AI that I find really exciting and that I think that will help us accelerate research in cancer.
I mean, if you wanted to make a simplistic kind of comparison, I mean, chat, you know, GCT in terms of a word processing vehicle using AI becomes very good based upon more data that you fill into it. So you have your first run, and you say, okay, that looks good, but, you know, add some more information about this, 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 this. So we look at that in terms of healthcare. You know, we've already seen AI being able to take a look at a pathology sample and be able to say, all right, this looks like it is a metastatic, you know, sample. Now I think the key thing is, though, when can we be at the point of being able to look at that first sample, the original biopsy sample, and then maybe look at the sample of the tissue as it's progressed to advanced stage, and then be able to say, with given the input as you talk about, this will become metastatic or it won't become metastatic, it'll become lethal or it won't become lethal?
Well, if we put the example of prostate cancer, because it's what I work on, and you also know about the topic, many men undergo biopsies of the prostate that do not find cancer. But some of them, over the years, may end up developing cancer. So one potential application of AI is to learn if there is anything in those original biopsies that is different in those who will later develop cancer, and maybe a pattern that we are not able to identify with the bare eye. Still, to do that, you need to feed that information into the system, so you still need to follow these men longitudinally over the years and collect their clinical evolution. So it's not like it's replacing the way that we do research, but creating another tool that may help us be more precise. So in that respect, I think that AI can help us predict outcomes, but that's not a new thing. That's what we do in research, try to create predictive biomarkers. I think it gives us the opportunity to develop new biomarkers and new methodologies to assess those biomarkers. And what is interesting, I think that it also opens new avenues for expanding research and these advances beyond those centers, those academic hospitals with expertise, because you may be able to access these tools on remote, even if you are not receiving healthcare at one of these academic institutions. So I see a lot of possibilities, but we are still in the early days. So we need to see how it pans out and how it impacts. I was at a session, it was some 1 year ago, I think, and it was a session about, it was a coaching session for researchers, but it was a talk about our society and the different revolutions along history. And one of the things that the guy was telling us is you have to probably accept that this is a generation that is seeing the beginning of a revolution, but will not see the end of it. So you are kind of in the middle between two eras, and we have to accept that this AI revolution, it's probably gonna be, it's only gonna be 5 or 10 years until we see changes, but it's probably gonna be 50 to 100 years until we see it consolidated.
Right.
So we're gonna see a lot of hype and deception in the next few years.
Something to look forward to. We best talk more with Dr. Mateo and some closing comments right after this.
Watch the northern lights flash. Took a photograph on a Paris street. Have you ever climbed a tall tree? Asked someone for mercy. Gave something away that wasn't free. I don't wanna get a vision of you stuck in my head, because I know that you were meant to be wilder. Another night of television while you're lying in bed is slowly gonna be the death of you. Thank you.
And that was Have You Ever Lived by Michael Shines. Well, you're still very engaged in doing cancer research. Now, where can our listeners find out more about the studies you're engaged in, involved in, ongoing, and how can you become part of them?
Yes, yeah, so my research group is at the Valdebron Institute of Oncology, the Valdebron campus. I mean, you can go to the website, bhio.net, and then there is a overview of what we do. I think it's not the website, the best website ever, sorry, it's still in process, but you can see like the main lines of research. There is like contact for the institution, for information, for fundraising. And then some of our projects have specific websites where patients or potential participants or anyone who is interested can go and can get more information. One is this Ironman registry that I told you about. We are collecting data from 5,000 men suffering from prostate cancer for all over the world, data and blood samples, and there is a website dedicated to that. There is ironmanregistry.org. And now we have also launched quite a cool project. I'm biased because I'm engaged in it, but to me it's an interesting thing that I have told you about. That is a project to facilitate the access to genomic testing for men who are diagnosed of advanced prostate cancer anywhere in Spain. And this is something that, so there was a similar project going on in the US a few years ago that motivated me to do so. And this is called the HOPE Prostate Project. And we have a dedicated website that is HOPE Prostata. So sorry for the confusion, but it's HOPE in English and Prostata in Spanish, .com. And it's a platform where actually patients can go and register also to be participant. So differently to other research study, there are no centers in between. So it's not through the doctor, but it's the patient directly who volunteers to participate, and then they can find there the information about how to send their tumor and blood sample to us for analysis, and we send them the results so they can share them with their doctors. So this would be the main ways. And then the other thing that we try to do, Virgil, and you have been a big supporter of this over the years, is that when we find something new or we make a new scientific publication, we try to disseminate this through specific events, but also through press releases and contact with the media. So actually the people who are outside the science world know what are we doing. And I think that it is very important, first of all, because part of what we're doing is done with public money, so, you know, taxpayers' money, so we need to explain them what we have done. But also because I truly believe that cancer research is not only made by the researchers, but it's a society duty.
Exactly.
So engaging people and making them aware of what's going on, it's part of moving forward as a society.
There's no question about it in my mind. I think the whole thing is that, you know, if the problem is part of the society, solution is too. And I think the more and more we as individuals can educate ourselves about cancer and its impacts, the more we can do in terms of helping you do a better job of finding, you know, cures and protocols to benefit all of us from that standpoint. So I think, you know, and I think the genome thing is really, I love that. I mean, you've talked about it for years, and I think the fact that you guys are doing it now is amazing. You know, no, so we'll put that up on our website and our Facebook page so you folks can check it out.
Well, that'll be cool because it's been hard to set it up. A lot of work in the last 2 years, but we started 3 months ago, and we think that it's an educational project because one of the problems of these new technologies is that many doctors may not be necessarily experts in how to use them, so it's an educational project for them to get familiar with this kind of technology, but it's also a way to facilitate the access and empowering the patient to get access to these new technologies, and we hope that way to reduce inequalities of healthcare. So it doesn't really matter where you live or what hospital are you being treated on.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us again today. It's been great. You're a great guest as always, and been too long.
I'll hope to come more often. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. We're going to leave you today with a song from Rex Banner called Vino for Two, which has been a part of my own personal healthcare plan. So have a great one, Barcelona. We'll talk to you next week.